On this week's edition of New York Now, COVID-19 clusters pop up in downstate New York and the state cracks down.
Attack these clusters.
Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio and Bill Mahoney from Politico New York join me to discuss that and more. President Trump nominates a conservative favorite to the Supreme Court. We'll have details and analysis with court watcher Vin Bonventry from Albany Law School. And it's about halfway through the fall semester at the state's colleges. New SUNY Chancellor Jim Mellotras tells us how it's going and what's ahead for the statewide university system. I'm Dan Clark, and this is New York Now.
Today, the Senate majority will pass legislation.
We will pass a law prohibiting it, and we will take them to court challenging it.
Yet another stand for New York and sending a message to the nation.
Welcome to this week's edition of New York Now. I'm Dan Clark. While the rest of the country was watching the presidential debate this week, New York saw a handful of clusters of COVID-19 pop up in Brooklyn and the lower Hudson Valley. And it's probably the worst time for that to happen. Schools just started classes in September and we're now entering flu season. Governor Andrew Cuomo says the state isn't planning to go back to any sort of lockdown, but that they're targeting resources toward these new clusters.
Once you have this information, aggressively target these clusters, okay? These are embers that are starting to catch fire in dry grass. Send all the firefighting equipment and personnel to those embers and stamp out the embers right away.
With me in studio to talk about that and much, much more is Bill Mahoney from Politico New York and Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio. Thank you both so much for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank
you. So, Karen, let's go to you first. Let's talk about these clusters. So it's been a while since we saw COVID really go up in New York State. We're seeing these really dangerous spikes. Where are they?
They're in parts of Brooklyn, Queens, Rockland and Orange counties. A lot of them are associated with the Orthodox Jewish community. Also, there's some clusters upstate. There's one in Horseheads in the Southern Tier, and it had to do with a church service. And actually more worrisome, this information just come in the last day or two, is that in Binghamton, there's a mini outbreak, and the officials can't really trace it to one event, which means that it could be community spread, not to alarm anybody. But that's the big
I'm a little alarmed.
Yeah, but that's the big question. You know, can these clusters stay as clusters and be contained and get people there who maybe aren't complying with social distancing or wearing masks to do that? Or is it going to become community spread? Because I feel like, you know, to use that expression, we've seen this movie before. I remember sitting in Governor Cuomo's briefing room back in March, him talking about an outbreak in New Rochelle and how they were taking all these steps to contain it. And then within 2 weeks, we were like completely shut down. So
I remember thinking back in March, like March 1st, I think was our first case, that it was not going to be very serious. I remember saying to a lot of people like, don't worry about it, it's overblown. And that was just totally wrong.
Yeah.
So what is the state doing right now to try to tamp down these clusters, I guess, to try to prevent them from growing into a second wave?
Well, most people do wear masks. You have to wear masks in public. There are mostly are not large gatherings. There is social distancing. I mean, we're all sitting 6 feet apart.
Right.
So perhaps that will help. But who knows? I mean, it's really hard to know. This is going to be a big test in the next few weeks, isn't it? Is there community spread, or will COVID just come back in clusters that can be contained through, you know, social distancing and other technology? It's hard to say. It's a scary time right now, waiting to see what happens.
And I was thinking it would be a really big test of, have we learned from our mistakes, I guess, the first time around? Are we going to take steps this time to try to prevent it from getting any bigger? And I think the indication is, just from the past day's numbers, is that we can hopefully get it under control, but we will see. Something that we're going to be watching, of course. Bill, I want to go to you next.
Right.
The Independent Redistricting Commission met this week. A lot of people don't know what that is. I'm even a little bit fuzzy on why it exists. Tell me about it, and what were they looking at this week? This seems very early to start redistricting, but, you know, obviously I don't know anything about this.
Well, we haven't talked about it a lot since 2012, so
Anybody
would be forgiven if they don't remember the details. But flashback then, when they were doing the district lines for Congress and the state legislature, there was a big fight. Governor Cuomo ran for office promising to veto any lines that the legislature drew itself. They drew their own lines. They were just as horribly gerrymandered as they are pretty much every decade. But in exchange for signing them, he pushed through this compromise where it was this independent redistricting commission, which some people said was great. It's the best step forward in redistricting we've had in half a century. Others said it probably wasn't going to work as well as advertised. But starting in 2021, 2022, once we got the new census numbers, this is going to take over the redistricting process. And fast forward, we're getting pretty close to those dates. We're about a year away from when they need to start coming out with some maps and having the public be able to review them. So this commission's getting to work. But lo and behold, they had their first meeting yesterday. And their task right now, since we don't have the census numbers yet, is to basically start hiring executive directors, staff, the people who can start cranking out these maps and looking at the numbers as soon as we get the census numbers. But the money that's been in the budget to let them do this, the governor's office has just been sitting on it and not shared it with them. So we're off to a bit of a rough start. We still have some time to go, but all this hope of getting it started early and making sure that we have a full public review process, it's hit a speed bump right out of the gate.
The difference now from 2012 and from many decades is that Democrats control both houses of the legislature. And I guess that's the big question, right? Even though this is supposedly an independent commission, are the Democrats going to be able to draw the lines just as they like to keep the Republicans out as long as possible, which really essentially is what the Republicans in the Senate did to the Democrats for many, many decades?
That's actually one of the big questions on the ballot this November. Democrats currently have 40 seats out of the 63 in the Senate, thanks to some massive gains they made 2 years ago. But the constitutional amendment that created this commission basically said it's composed essentially of four Democrats, four Republicans, a couple independent people. It needs to have some sign off from all of them in order to create lines, and then it sends them to the legislature. Basically, it said that if Republicans control the legislature, they can just pass the lines as is,
right,
and do what they want with they have a majority. But it also said if Democrats ever took back the Senate, they need a supermajority of 42 seats to basically ignore the lines and draw what they want, gerrymander the Republicans into oblivion and turn a blue state into one that's permanently blue in the Senate, just like it kind of has been in the Assembly for decades. So if they can pick up two seats in the Senate this year, Democrats will have the power to basically ignore this commission and do what they want, and the Republican Party could become a thing of the past. And so that's something that to keep an eye on in November, where, you know, Republicans are making a go at taking the majority. I don't think a lot of people at this point are confident they can flip the eight seats in a presidential year. They would need to have the majority. But their goal right now should probably be, at the very least, stop Democrats from picking up two more, because if not, by the time 2022 comes around, there might be no path for them to ever come back into power in New York.
You're right. If they're drawn out, if it makes it that much more difficult to get to win, then they're probably not going to come back for a long time.
Well, we've seen in the Assembly, it's been since the 70s Republicans had a majority. The Democrats were able to draw their own lines, and now we've got most elections, it's like 107 out of the 150 seats are Democratic.
Right.
And best case scenario, Republicans might fight for 50 of those, and we could wind up in a similar situation in the Senate where the Republican Party is just a thing of the past if they don't have a decent showing this year.
You know, speaking of things, Karen, that aren't going to come back for a long time, possibly, are businesses. You had a story this week about how businesses are saying that if we have a second wave and we have to go back into a shutdown, that some just may not recover. And of course, we know that some have not recovered, but tell me what business leaders told you this week about that.
Well, I think what's amazing is that so many of the smaller businesses are still in business, because they really have their revenues cut so severely.
Yeah.
But I talked to the National Federation of Independent Business, and they surveyed their New York members. 40% of them say even under current conditions, they don't know if they're going to be in business in a year, let alone another shutdown. And they make the argument that they should be able to stay open, because they said in the spring, big box stores stayed open and they made a profit. And there really hasn't been any incidences of transmission of people going into their local hardware store or the grocery store and coming down with COVID-19. So they're making the case that it's relatively safe if they practice all the social distancing rules. But, you know, ultimately, we need the pandemic to end. I mean, that's what we need.
Yeah,
the ultimate solution.
We
right?
all need that. I think
yes,
so. Yeah,
exactly.
We'll leave it there. Karen DeWitt from New York State Public Radio, Bill Mahoney from Politico New York. Thank you both so much, as always. President Donald Trump announced the nomination of Amy Coney Barrett to the U.S. Supreme Court last weekend, and broadly, we know she's considered to be a relatively conservative judge. But there's also a lot that we don't know about her, and it's easy to get caught up in the headlines about her appointment. I wanted to know more about what to expect out of her, so I spoke with Vin Bonventri, a resident expert on the Supreme Court and a professor at Albany Law School. Vin Bonventri from Albany Law School, thanks so much for being here.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Dan.
So, Vin, what would the Supreme Court look like with Amy Coney Barrett on the bench? She's been characterized as a conservative justice, obviously, but I'm wondering broadly, what would the Supreme Court look like if she joined their ranks?
Well, you have to remember, we just lost Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who was perhaps the most politically liberal member of the court. Amy Barrett looks like she's going to be one of the most conservative, politically conservative justices on the court. So instead of having four liberals on the court, you now have three liberals on the court. And instead of having, you know, five conservatives, four of them very conservative, you will now have five very conservative court justices, which means that the justices, the conservative ones, won't even need Chief Justice Roberts to get a fifth vote. That's really, really, that's really going to shake up the court.
So let's look at her record on the bench, which I should mention for our viewers is not very long. She was appointed to the Seventh Circuit in 2017 by President Trump. Before that, she was largely in academia for most of her career. So let's start with immigration. Because I think that's going to be one of the top issues that the court looks at over the next couple of years. What is she in terms of a judge looking at immigration? Is she more prone to side with undocumented immigrants, or does she have any experience ruling on that?
Well, Dan, when I say politically conservative, remember, I say that advisedly. I do not mean judicially conservative. I mean, she talks about originalism, but, you know, originalism is in the line with strict constructionist. Oh, I'm a textualist. Oh, I'm a judicial restraintist. You know, now it's I'm originalist. Okay, that's just code for socially and politically conservative, which is why the social and political conservatives want her. Her record, to the extent that she has one, and she actually has a pretty large record to date. She's written over 100 opinions, many of them dissents. With regard to immigration, even when her court supported immigrants, she dissented against the right of immigrants, whether it was immigrants having a hearing or whether it was immigrants complaining about due process rights. She's a consistent vote against the immigrants. Okay, so yeah, I mean, that's what I mean by politically conservative. Think of how a politically conservative Republican politician would vote on many of these issues. That's the way she seems to be voting. That shouldn't be a surprise to anybody unless you're really gullible about this originalism stuff.
So is it the same with abortion? I know a lot of people are concerned about Roe v. Wade and whether having her on the court and if a case that includes abortion gets to the Supreme Court, that she would essentially write on the opinion that Roe v. Wade should be overturned. Is that where she is as well?
Yes, there are two major cases in which she participated while she was on the appellate court. And in both cases, she was in the dissent against abortion rights. One of them had to do with whether or not in prohibiting abortions for juveniles, for women who were not yet adults, whether they could have a judicial bypass, go to a judge instead of the parents, go to a judge who would say, yes, this is definitely justified. The court said, yes, you need that judicial bypass. Judge Barrett said, no, not even the judicial bypass. And then with regard to whether or not someone who wants an abortion, a woman who wants an abortion, wants one for several different reasons, may the state government say, well, you can't have an abortion for this reason, or that reason. The majority of the court threw that out, said that was unconstitutional. She voted in favor of it. So we have two major abortion cases. She voted against abortion rights both times. Not only that, she has written and spoken against Roe versus Wade.
Are there any Easter eggs about Amy Coney Barrett? Are there any decisions or writings that she has done or written that may not line up necessarily with a conservative ideology? Does she have anything, I guess, special out there that's hiding?
You know, we don't know yet. We don't know yet, and I know that there is concern about the fact that she's apparently a charismatic Catholic. Well, does that translate into a Catholic who's very, very dogmatic? So you can't do this, you can't do this, you can't do that. Or is she going to turn into a Sermon on the Mount Catholic? We don't know exactly where she is. We know she's a very devout Catholic. Is she going to be dogmatic? Or is she going to be a St. Francis and a Sermon on the Mount Catholic? I look forward to seeing that. To tell you the truth, I don't know, and I don't think anybody else does either.
You know, Republicans are obviously going to confirm her. They're planning to. It's not a sure bet, but they're planning to confirm her. The big controversial part of this, I think, is that this is happening right before a presidential election, during an election year. Give us the precedent for this. I know, obviously, in 2016, the Republicans blocked Merrick Garland from being confirmed. He was President Obama's nominee that year.
Yeah.
But looking back through history, is it typical for the Senate to block these kind of nominations during a presidential election year, or have they not had trouble with it before?
Okay, first of all, I mean, let's not be surprised that some politicians might be hypocrites. I mean, come on, give me a break. I'm not sure that the Democrats wouldn't do the exact same thing if they were in power. In terms of precedent, well, you can go all the way back to near the beginning of the Republic when the second president, John Adams, actually appointed the Chief Justice after he had already lost the election to Thomas Jefferson, right? And so it was just a few days before Thomas Jefferson was inaugurated, right? That that Adams' appointment, nomination to be Chief Justice, the great John Marshall, he was confirmed and he was appointed. So, I mean, come on, you know, when it goes against you, you become very, very pure. Oh, how could you do this? I mean, the Constitution allows Trump to do this. The Constitution allows the Republican Senate to do it. The Democrats lost the election 4 years ago. These are the consequences. I don't like it. I think it's unfair. But who said politics is fair? I've never said that of you.
That's a good point. Vin Bonventry from Albany Law School, thank you so much for being here.
Hey, great to be with you, Dan.
Republicans are planning to confirm Barrett to the Supreme Court sometime in late October. But in the meantime, the state's colleges and universities are almost halfway through the fall semester. And it's been tricky for the state to reopen colleges while keeping everyone safe. Plus, there's now the possibility of funding cuts for SUNY. SUNY Chancellor Jim Mylotras joined me this week to discuss. Chancellor Jim Mylotras, thanks so much for being here.
It's nice to be with you, Dan. Thanks.
Anytime. So classes have started about a month ago now. SUNY campuses have been open. And to be honest with you, I'm surprised that more campuses haven't been closed. Obviously, you have some guidelines for what would constitute remote learning at those campuses. Have we seen any upticks at SUNY campuses in recent days that you know, people should be aware of around the state?
And you're so cynical, expecting more chaos on our campuses. I think it's a testament to what the SUNY community has been doing. And we came up with a pretty aggressive three-part plan. One, more testing, which we can now do because of SUNY Upstate Medical, our premier upstate medical university, came up with a saliva test where we can produce up to 120,000 tests a week. So that's been a game changer for us. Second piece is more data transparency. We require all of our campuses to report every 24 hours how many tests they've done, how many positive cases there are, how many students are in isolation, so we can monitor this in real time. And the third piece was enhanced compliance. The good thing is a vast majority of our students and everyone are complying with the rules in this new kind of day, new normal. But unfortunately, there's still a few who aren't, which have led to some outbreaks, which you've seen on a couple of our campuses. We've increased the penalties. We've said we're serious about this. And I think that has slowed down the spread of the virus. And when you do see problems emerge, you saw that at SUNY Oneonta, you saw that at SUNY Oswego, we act very aggressively because this is a public health matter. We take those things very seriously, and we're going to continue to act aggressively as those things emerge to hopefully keep the overall virus down across our system.
So let's talk about that testing, because I think it's so cool what you're able to do with this. So not to sound disgusting, but you basically take the saliva of a bunch of people, and this is why it's called pooled testing, and you put it in this, you know, container, whatever you're testing it in, and then you test that whole batch so that you don't have to test people individually, which I think is really cool. It's allowed you to now test every student in the SUNY system every 2 weeks. But if you were to go back before the semester started, if you could do it over again, would you rather keep students off campus until we have that testing mechanism in place?
See, I can't go backwards because I just became the SUNY as of the beginning of September. All I could do is move forward. We have the technology, so we're going to use the technology. And I think what you're going to get out of my chancellorship is aggressive action to combat the virus, use every tool that we have in the toolbox. Now that I have that tool, we're going to aggressively use that tool. We're requiring all of our campuses to test now. That's not an option. It's a requirement. And I think it's been working now because you can see ongoing testing on all of our schools. So we're going to keep using all the innovations that we have here. And hopefully we can keep increasing our capacity on our campuses. Because in the end, what I'm hearing as I go around as the new chancellor, students are happy to be back. It was really hard to end in-person learning in March. It was really disruptive to their educational opportunities and experience. And most of the students I talk to say, I'm so glad to be back here. It's a little unusual the way we're back because it's a little different, but they don't want to go home. So this is allowing us to keep our campuses open. And I think it's been a really important thing for us to continue to focus on.
So let's talk about enforcement since campuses are open. At SUNY Oneonta, obviously, we had the problem where students were going out and throwing parties and the virus was just spreading. And I know that that's not uncommon on SUNY campuses. We hope that students will not throw those parties. But now you have new enforcement rules. Tell me about them, because I know a lot of people are worried that this might not be as closely watched. So I understand that SUNY campuses will now be able to immediately suspend students who do something that may spread the virus, which would include parties off campus, but it also includes things like if you're showing symptoms, you should quarantine yourself. You shouldn't go out onto campus and interact with other people, right?
I feel like I'm the no fun chancellor, but the unfortunate thing is we are still living with COVID. We still don't have a vaccine and we still see how quickly this can spread. Oneonta was instructive to, I think, a lot of people. That was really, when it came down to it, was one party of 50 individuals. Those 50 individuals, several were positive. It spread like wildfire through that school. So we have a zero tolerance policy on this. Dan, it's not just the individual, it's not just parties. It is people who violate the isolation protocols, for instance. Isolation means you have the virus. So you should be isolated for 2 weeks subject to a Department of Health order. If you violate that, there should be serious consequences. So I think it strikes the right balance, but it sends a serious tone. And I think most students are complying with this. And we just hope that very small number of students who remain non-compliant kind of come to their senses and say, you have real repercussions in your academic life potentially, but put that aside. This is common sense. Don't impact the rest of your community. Think about everyone involved here, not just yourself.
So speaking of the student body, I want to talk to you about enrollment, because I know that's been a problem at private colleges. Obviously, COVID-19 has hit everyone's finances, and I think that might be the case for SUNY students as well. I was wondering if you've seen a drop-off in enrollment at all this year, as students may not be able to afford to come back to campus or start their college career.
Our enrollment is down a little more overall because of the virus. I will say this, Dan. We've had this pattern in changing landscape in higher education well before COVID has come into our state. So we've been dealing and grappling with this situation for a long time. What I want to do is transition beyond COVID, because I want to demonstrate that we can keep our campuses open first, even under COVID. And then how do we grow the SUNY system? I love the SUNY system. Public higher education is important to me because I am a product of public higher education. The first SUNY chancellor ever to be a graduate of the system, which I still think is a little made up, but I'll take it because it's important to me. I'm only here because of SUNY. So yes, our enrollment is down. COVID has accelerated and exacerbated some of those problems. We have to address those things. The federal government has to stand up and give us some more money because we are facing some serious financial challenges, but I see opportunity here. When I hear 50,000 students have gone somewhere else, I want to recapture those 50,000 students. When I hear students going to other systems across the country, I want to get those students back because I think SUNY's second to none, but it's up to us to demonstrate the value to them.
You know, speaking of financial challenges, obviously, aside from the federal government, the state government may be forced to cut spending on SUNY in the near future because of our massive budget deficit. How is that going to affect SUNY campuses across the state? I know people are wondering that as they send their kids to school and as people come back to class.
Well, right now, the state has not taken any action, which has been tremendously helpful to us. So we haven't had to do any of those reductions. In fact, working with the state, we have kept important programs like the tuition assistance program and Excelsior and other programs fully operational, or our EOP, our educational opportunity programs, which provides academic access to many disadvantaged community members. Those programs are all running. Those are really critical for enrollment and critical for us to grow. But if we do come to a situation where the federal government hasn't responded and provided funding, we may face some difficult choices. We're hopeful that they will respond. They'll see the value in public institutions like education or healthcare and other places. We're not there yet, luckily, but we'll have to address it if it does come our way. But we're hopeful that we will have a response from stakeholders in funding.
All right. New SUNY Chancellor Jim Elantris, always great to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
We'll be watching how things play out at the state's colleges over the next couple of months. But next week, join us for an interview with former Governor David Paterson about his new memoir, Black, Blind, and In Charge. Until then, thanks for watching this week's New York Now. Have a great week and be well.